Hey guys, my name is Sabir Bharti and a very warm welcome to the Sabir Bharti Show, the place where I interview interesting people with interesting perspectives. And today's guest is professional photographer Inzajino Latif. He is passionate about giving voice to people by unearthing places and faces that are all too often ignored and overlooked. Inzajino's work has been published in some very well-known publications, including The Telegraph magazine, as well as Time magazine. And he's also photographed some very well-known personalities as well, including actor Andrew Scott and TV personality Ian Hislop, just to name a few. If you want to follow Inzajino's work, you can do so by visiting his website, which is inzajino.com. That's spelled Inzajano.com. You can also follow his fabulous work on Instagram by following him there using the handle @_Inzajino. Super, super excited. So much to get through in this next hour or so. So without further ado, a very warm welcome to Inzajino Latif. Hello.
Hey, man. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm very well. Thank you so much for joining me on the show. And we were just talking off air there and trying to recall how long it's been since we last met. And I reckon it's been a good 8 or 9 years, right?
Easily, yeah. Yeah. And you still look so youthful.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. And, you know, it's been fabulous to see your work. I've actually been following your work mainly on LinkedIn. And often I come across your updates in relation to your photography work. So with your permission, that's where I wanted to start. And I found very interesting the details that you put on your website, in particular, your work ethic and your mission. And I just want to read something out and then perhaps ask you to elaborate on that a bit more. So you say that you're passionate about giving voice to people by unearthing places and faces that are all too often ignored and overlooked. So if you wouldn't mind, I just wanted you to perhaps just expand and delve into that a bit more, just to give us an idea of where this mission came from.
Yeah, sure. So I guess this way of working, which has evolved over time, I guess I've kind of nurtured it and I've began to understand different aspects of it through time. But its core started when we moved from the north of England, from Bradford down to London. My mum, she was a seamstress, and you know, things in Bradford financially were quite tough. She worked 2 to 3 jobs. She was the main breadwinner. I didn't really see my father that much. So she decided, you know, for a better life for us and herself, let's move down to London. The pay was slightly higher. She had some family down there. So we moved down to North London, Tottenham, which for me was like, whoa, like, where the hell am I, kind of thing, you know, like you go from being around, you know, more or less your, you know, people that are from the same background as you, share the same kind of culture, and then you're kind of flung into this place where hardly any South Asians at all, hardly any, you know, a very predominant Afro-Caribbean community. That was exciting, but it also had a lot of challenges, you know, because we were the odd family out. So, you know, at the offset, I began to feel like, you know, I'm kind of invisible. And the only time I would become visible was when, you know, I was hurled racial abuse, when I was beaten up, when I was mugged. So, you know, I started to kind of think about things in a very, I guess at that time, really black and white way. you know, like almost like this us and them, because that's how it felt, you know, like all, you know, like the community from Africa had their little circle, the community from West Indies, Jamaica had their little circle, everyone had their little circles, and it was only every now and again when everyone dipped their toes into each other's pots, if you like. So I, you know, started to, from these experiences, what emerged was, you know, I am a bit of an outsider. I am, at least I was made to feel at that time, really different. So then you start to get into this like micro separation, you know, when the fact of the matter is, every person of color is going through the same struggle, especially in areas like Tottenham. So many years later, in around 2006, I decided to take up photography. Now, you know, I'd always been involved in arts in some way. Before this, I ran music labels. I was a DJ, a very popular DJ. I'll mention no names. So the whole idea of art as a statement, art as a vehicle for change, art as an excuse to an extent to kind of say what you feel, to express yourself, was always there. And, you know, through starting photography, it became really apparent very quickly that I have found this new language, this new way of being able to convey the message of not only myself, who, you know, I'm also that invisible person. I'm also the underrepresented person. So, you know, like in the statement you've read, as much as that is about the people that I care about, it's equally about me. Well, you know, so that's what started things off, and that's what started to kind of take me down this road of exploration, of realization, and of shock and of horror, because the more you read, the more you research, the more you explore, the more you understand how corrupt the system is, and how the system is very much designed and maintained to not allow people of color, and also people of a lower class. It doesn't allow us to get ahead, or at the very least, it makes it very challenging for us.
Yeah, sure.
That's where the journey began.
Right. Well, thank you for sharing that. And that's very interesting you say that. And I guess that leads very nicely onto another piece of writing that I saw on your website as well, which is, I guess, a bit of a follow-on to what I read out earlier. Now, this is your description of your work and what your work means to you and how you go about creating the stories that you do. So you say, when I create, I invest time in people, frequent their places to begin to understand the spaces they inhabit and begin to understand them. It's only then I start extracting and making images that can do those communities justice. So I guess that follows on to what you were discussing just a moment ago. Why did you find focusing on people's stories specifically so powerful? What was it about that really drew you in?
It's a really good question, and it kind of happened naturally. When I seriously started making longer bodies of work, and when I say longer bodies of work, I mean pieces of work that take months, often years, you know, to kind of really start to peel back the layers and allow the viewer to understand what's going on, to get a sense of the place. So naturally I was, you know, I leaned towards, you know, speaking to people, you know, like a lot of my work, for example, the series, This Is Tottenham, that's hours and days spent walking around, speaking to people, you know, genuinely speaking to them, not because, you know, I want to take their photo, because 8 times out of 10, people don't let me take their photographs. You know, there's a real sense of paranoia in Tottenham, at least when I first started the work. People didn't want their names to be mentioned. If they wanted to be photographed, they were like, yeah, that's fine, but don't mention my name and whatnot. You know, so there was this layer of secrecy to some extent that people wanted to maintain. And what emerged from that is this sense of, you know, not trusting the system, you know, like who might see this? What might people think? What might they think? And they was often used as a term to describe the system. So, you know, speaking to people and just really engaging in their stories. And for me as well, it was kind of like a, it's like a healing kind of process started, because I could finally relate to people that had similar experiences to me. People that were from broken homes, people whose parents might have experienced some form of domestic violence. Maybe they themselves has had experienced some form of verbal or physical abuse. You know, so it was really refreshing to kind of start to kind of suddenly think about these people as like, this is my community. Like, these are my people and I'm theirs and they're mine. So it really started to kind of allow me to focus in on what I wanted to kind of extract. You know, I was taking photos for about 10 years. And I've heard an insane amount of stories, sad, happy, and everything in between. And it's just this natural love, I guess, this genuine care that I have for people, you know, and wanting to use photography, use this beautiful art form that I guess in many ways now has been used to manipulate and push the truth to regions where I don't think it should go. But I guess, you know, like in all this smoke, I still maintain photography's purity, at least to share what I feel is the truth.
Sure. And we were also speaking off air on email a few days ago, and you gave me some very insightful information about the deeper part of Invisible Latif, which I found intriguing. You said that you are you described yourself rather as a thinker and a fighter, and someone who stands up for what you to believe in, or stands up for what you believe in, sorry. So I'd be interested to know if these traits, or how these traits, if at all, translate over into your work. So these being a thinker and a fighter, and I guess standing up for what you believe in is very much integral in your work already.
Yes, you know, so I guess now, all my work, you know, this is Tottenham. If you look at the work I'm also making in Lincoln Heights in Cincinnati, you know, it's very much about the resilience in minorities. You know, the fact that no matter what happens, no matter what crap you have to take, you know, no matter how many years of this we have to endure, we're still here and we'll still fight. Sometimes people don't realize the end result because it's just, you know, like your life ends and you move on. Nonetheless, I met people in their 90s that have the same fire as someone who's in their teens. That for me shows that it's really important to keep on striving for what we believe in. You know, change, especially now, is something that's being challenged in ways that we can't really imagine or we never thought of. You know, so my work sits at the intersection of anything is possible if you put your mind to it, if the work is crafted in a way that reveals truths about these people. A lot of the work is very formally framed. That's on purpose. I want the images to confront the viewer. There's usually text. Sometimes it's written by myself. Sometimes I work with writers. So, for example, with this is Tottenham. I was so lucky to get a professor of urban studies from the Buffalo University, Professor Henry Taylor, who's who wrote a fantastic piece about the whole idea of Tottenham, what it means. From his experience, he's worked in similar areas like Tottenham, because Tottenham is not a one-off. Lincoln Heights is a Tottenham. He was describing spaces in South America that are Tottenham. I've lived in South Africa. I've seen areas that are Tottenham, so everywhere in the world, the same fight is being fought. And for me, this work feeds into that fight and hopefully allows conversations to be had from a different perspective, as opposed to the, same old kind of politics or media kind of outlet, just a different way.
Yeah, sure. Now, of course, as well as this fabulous work that you've been involved in helping people tell their individual stories, it was very nice to also see on your website that you've been, or your work's been published in some very well-known publications, including, I believe it was Telegraph Magazine and Time Magazine, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah. And it was so cool to see your photography up there. And in particular, I noticed you did some work with the TV personality Ian Hislop and the actor Andrew Scott. So I found that really interesting. And I was excited to ask you this question because I know you do some tremendous work by giving voices to underrepresented people and communities, but you also have been exposed to the other side of the photography world, where you're often working with well-known personalities and publications. So how have you found that transition personally of switching hats, if you like, from one type of photography to quite another?
Yeah, I guess for me, it was quite easy.
Right.
And I guess I say that because there was so much learned experience in the background, so when I started to kind of do these editorial shoots, I really had a sense of, what I wanted, how I wanted to kind of work as well. So and one of the main things about my approach is I'm not going to compromise. I'm gonna, whatever work I do, I want it to have my look. So when people see it, they know, oh, that is Inzaghino's work. Maybe due to the composition, the color, the lighting, etc. So for me, it was an easy transition. I'm used to working quick. Often with a lot of these jobs, often with a lot of these jobs, you only get a few minutes, literally a few minutes. So I would go there early. I would compose my shot first. And then when, the actors or whatnot were ready, I'd say, look, guys, let's go. Bang. In the frame, I would mostly shoot film. So on one roll of film, I had 10 shots. And that's all I do. 10 shots right there. Let's go. Done. And then obviously you have to sweat and keep your fingers crossed something on those negatives when you get the film processed. So yeah, lots of excitement.
But it's just what you described it there towards the end. It seems like at times it can be quite a high pressure environment where, as you said, you've got your fingers crossed for a positive outcome. Have you ever had cases where it hasn't gone as you'd planned? Have you ever had any sticky moments? And the reason I ask is it's sometimes nice just to see how someone handles those type of situations where you're thrown with unexpected moments, but you've had to kind of think on your feet to make it work.
I have got the perfect story. No one's heard this story apart from my wife. I got the job for Time Magazine.
Yeah.
That was to shoot a feature in the USA in Indianapolis. So I flew over there. And, you know, I got in rather easily for a change. It was nice when you go to America. And, you know, my excuse was, you know, like, I'm here for the NASCAR racing. That's why I've got my cameras. You know, I'm here for that. And it was like, yeah, great. I was like, yeah. You know, so I get the brief. And me being very, is it stubborn or just, you know, focusing on my look in terms of like the aesthetic that I wanted, I only had my medium format analog camera. And obviously, you know, because I'm in America, stupidly now, but back then I was like, yeah, look, there's going to be loads of labs in America. I'm going to shoot the film and it's going to be great. It's going to be fine. It's going to be fantastic. So I have to shoot, I think, 3 or 4 people. So I get that done. That all went well. The engagement with the participants was fantastic. The mood was good. I knew, you know, like I had an idea of the mood I was kind of going for visually. And then it came to getting the film processed. And obviously, you know, most of the time when you work for magazines like Time Magazine, they want the images yesterday, you know? So it's like, okay, you know, I can have this turned around in a day, maximum 2 days. They were okay with that. So now I need to find a lab.
Yeah.
So I'm, you know, checking Google for labs. There's no local labs. I'm like, this is a bit strange, you know, what's going on? And then I find a lab. The lab is like 80 miles away from where I'm staying. So I drive down there and I'm all excited because I found the lab, and I know that the lab is going to have superbly clean chemicals, great machinery, everything will be great. I walk in and there's a young lady at the counter. And as soon as I saw her and the equipment, tiny alarm bells started to ring in my head. So I asked them, you know, like, are your chemicals maintained and all this? Yeah. They're all maintained. They're great. They're fantastic. I said, okay, cool. Gave them the film. Drove back 80 miles. The next day, I drive back down. And I get the film back and I'm like looking at the negs, like there's like the exposures are all off. Oh yeah. You know, we had some problems with the machine.
Wow.
That's like, what? Okay. Nothing you can do. Nothing you can do. There was something on the negs. It just wasn't the density that I'm used to. Anyway, next step, need to get them scanned. Of course, you know, I'm in America, everyone's got a scanner. Scanners are available everywhere. Of course not. Of course not. Why would a scanner be available? There's a certain type of scanner you need when you scan film. Well, there's a few different types. No one had them. Then I call up one organization. Yep, we've got one. You can borrow it. Last minute. Oh no, something's happened. You can't use it. Then I called the Library of Indianapolis. Begging, like crying on the phone. Like, do you have anything that I can use to scan film? The lady goes, yeah, we do. I said, what have you got? Oh, we've got a Nikon scanner. I was like, oh my God. Thank you. Thank you. Now, I get there. Obviously, you can't have everything. There was no glass holder, so the negs wouldn't stay flat. Anyway, I scan. I get the best out of the scanner. The images are very moody. They are very grainy. I send them off to the editors at time, and then I don't hear anything back for like 3 days. And I kid you not, Sabir, I am almost in tears. I'm like, they've seen these images. They don't like them. This was the chance I had, and I've blown it. Everyone's gonna know that I can't be trusted. And then when things were getting really low and I was sweating, I didn't sleep, I didn't eat, I was highly anxious, and I was dripping with sweat for at least 24 hours, like at least. Then I get a email. Hey, Inza, these are amazing. We love them. I showed them to the head photo editor.
Wow.
She is loving them. We love the mood. We love the grain. I'm like, yep, that's exactly what I was going for. So I guess to an extent, the moral is that, as long as you get something and you can make it work, just go with it. Just go with it. Because at the end of the day, look, there's nothing more you can do. Your intent, commitment, your perseverance was all 200%. Like if the images are not 100, but they're 85, you can make up the shortfall when you scan them and like you work on the images in Photoshop in some way, which I did, not much, but I did. And the images you see on the website, they are the images that I sent them.
Yeah, no, that's an amazing story. And that story actually really resonated with me because over the years, and this has kind of been somewhat my downfall at times, is that I'm always trying to be as close as possible to this idea of perfection. But the truth is, sometimes it's just not possible due to external factors. And I often used to put myself down whenever that used to happen, blaming myself. But it's really nice hearing that perspective from you. Because like you said, it doesn't matter how hard you try, sometimes things happen and you just have to adapt.
Yeah, totally, totally. And your point about this idea of perfection, I mean, like it took me a long time to let go of that. I would say only in the last year I let go of this illusion of perfection, because it is an illusion. I mean, look, even so for example, if you could achieve perfection, then what?
Then what exactly?
Like, where do you go from there? There's nowhere else to go because you've reached it. So for me, it's about the journey, and the processes are far more valuable than this ludicrous idea about, oh, it has to be perfect, or I can't show anyone because, like the color's slightly off. Like ultimately, these days, especially like in the photographic industry, not a lot of people know, and not a lot of people care. So do yourself a favor, let go, let things out, throw your work out there, throw yourself out there. Life is all a learning experience. Like there's no such thing as, perfection. It's simply an illusion.
Wow. Yeah, no, it's a fabulous insight, and yeah, very thought-provoking. Now, at the beginning, when you started sharing the story, you said perhaps only one other person knows about this story, which was your dear wife. And I know when we were speaking again off air a few days ago, you mentioned that getting married was quite a profound moment in your life. So with your permission, I'd love for you to share with us the effect that marriage had on you and why you believe that marriage was so profound.
So my wife is from Slovenia,
Okay.
and she's also an epidemiologist. So she's well educated, and she's also very intelligent. And she's got a lot of life experience. Like her work has allowed her to see the world. And so, we got married, and you suddenly realize that you really have to let go of your ego. And at the start, that's bloody difficult, because you don't realize that all these things that you're doing is because of your ego, and you're allowing your ego to get in the way. So there's that. Then also, my wife questions everything I do. Everything I do. And I love her for it, because it's made me think about everything I do. It's made me learn. It's made me appreciate. And it's made me let go of a lot of the burdens that I used to carry as well. We are touched on this idea of perfection. I've held so many things back because I felt that they're not ready. And then you have to ask yourself, when will it be ready? And my wife has always been this amazing, supportive voice. So at the same time, she plays the devil's advocate. And at first, that used to wind me up. I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle it. I was like, no. But now it's like, you know what? That's made me a better person. It's definitely made me a better person. It's made me look into myself. It's made me step back and look at situations that I otherwise maybe would have dealt with in an obstructive way. Due to her, I've experienced more of the world. I've experienced parts of the world that I would never go to usually. Once we were stationed in the Gambia, and she was doing a survey on malaria, which meant that we had to go and stay out in the field. So the field is when you go like deep into the countryside of wherever you are staying. And like me being this Westerner, whether I like it or not, I was like, man, I can't handle this. Like, the toilets are mad, there's insects everywhere, I'm sleeping on a crazy mattress, it's 40 Celsius, there's no air conditioning. And I would have a meltdown. I would literally have a meltdown, because like, you go there almost with this Western arrogance. And I realized really quickly that damn, that is, everything about that is wrong. Everything about that is wrong. Because on the other side, the people that we stayed with gave us their room where they would normally stay. That's a blessing. They gave us both their fans. That's a blessing. So it's, learning to kind of be more grateful about things, put things into perspective, and understand that no matter where you go, you won't get everything you want. And that's okay, because the times that you don't get things that you want is a learning experience, and it's a beautiful learning experience, and that feeds in to your character, to your way of life, to make you a better person, whether that's in day-to-day things or in your photographic work or whatever line of work you're in. If you can embrace what seem to be as challenges, all of a sudden you see them as gifts. So every day I thank God for meeting my wife, because she has taken me on such an amazing journey, and she still is. So I'm deeply, deeply thankful for that.
Amazing. And that's so beautiful to hear. And yeah, I really appreciate you sharing that part of your life. Now, something else we spoke about a few days ago was this concept of being open to new learnings. And this is something that I've been grappling with myself over the last, I'd say, 2 to 3 years, because when I had finished my time in TV working as a producer, at that time, I remember thinking, I know everything. I've learned a lot in the 5 years I'm here. Now I'm going to leave and put my energy into something else. But I've learned a hell of a lot and I'm kind of good to go. And I later realized, or soon after realized, that in fact, there's so much more yet for me to learn. And I was so wrong in thinking that I was kind of the finished article, so to speak. So that's something I've been grappling with recently over the last few years. And it was really nice to see you being open to say that, or being open and honest in saying that you've always been open to learnings, because you feel the learning cycle never stops or ceases. So I'd be interested to know, with your permission, moments in your life where you really had to dig deep and ask those sometimes difficult questions in order to progress and to learn.
Yeah, it's a good question. One experience I had was actually at my university. So towards the end of my third year doing my BA in photography, one of my images was selected as a final image for the Taylor Wesson Portrait Prize. So I was a finalist, basically. And it was an image of a female boxer. And this was back in 2009. So back then, I was always, you know, my work was still about the underdog, you know. So in this case, photographing females who play the supposedly gentleman sport, which is boxing. Now, that brought a lot of publicity to the university. And with the promises, there were all these other things. So one of them was, yeah, look, stay here, we'll get you lecturing, we'll get you teaching. And then when you finish, you know, you can continue to work as a lecturer in some form. I was like, that sounds great. This wasn't the case. This just did not happen. They favored a white colleague of mine over me, you know, which at the time was very hurtful. You know, I mean, all I've ever wanted from anyone is just be straight up. Yeah. You know, if there's something you can do, say it. If there's something you can't do, let me know. It's all good. Life goes on. So that for me was a really sort of pivotal moment, because I'd already invested in their masters, which, for the record, was absolutely hopeless. It was badly organized. It wasn't in tune with what photography was about in any way, shape or form. But what it did do, it got them a lot of students in. It got them a ton of students. You know, like, I recall getting tons of emails from potential students asking me about the course and my image. So, you know, so I realized then, I was like, wow, okay, you know, now I have to think about, you know, sort of going it alone once I leave university. And that was a very harsh lesson, because A, you know, like, in many ways, yeah, fine, I was let down by my lecturers. But at the same time, you know, I shouldn't have really expected anything from anyone, if I'm very honest with you. But I put a lot of loyalty into everything. And I guess I also put a lot of my emotions into it, into that whole scenario and experience. But suddenly you have to realize and wake up and think, okay, now you have to start something else. and you have to pursue being a photographer full time. It's already a very, very challenging industry. It's already an industry that's very insular. It's all about who you know. It's not really based about talent in many, many ways. It really isn't. It's also an industry that's run by very old white men. You know, so you know, there's a few kind of gatekeepers here and there. This is not an obvious thing, but when you're inside, you realize that. You know, so for someone like me, who photographs in a very contemporary manner, but doesn't fit the contemporary aesthetic, I suddenly realized that there are a lot of challenges in this industry, and a lot of challenges that I experienced straight away. You know, I would go and show my book to organizations, and as soon as they would see my face, the tone would change completely. Early on, most of the work I got was from art directors and editors who were Asian or brown. You know, so that kind of tells you a lot. You know, and I'm greatly thankful to them for, you know, seeing more than just me, you know, seeing the work for what it is. So, you know, you learn the lesson that even though there's all these challenges, are you going to stop? Are you going to just do something else? Or are you going to tear down every damn wall that comes in your way? I chose the latter, and I'm still tearing down those damn walls every single day, Sabir. Believe me.
Yeah.
Fight. But the beauty is that the work I make out of my lived experiences, I feel will resonate more and will stand the test of time. You know, I often, like, I have this thought that in 100 years time, people can look back at work like Lincoln Heights, like This Is Tottenham, and get a real understanding of the real people that lived in those spaces, the real children, the real adults, the real scenarios, the real emotions. You know, I don't think a lot of work does that these days, but I'm hoping that in 100 years time, mine does.
Yeah, mother, that's really interesting. And you know, before you wrap up, I just wanted to switch gears slightly, because there may be people watching perhaps who are budding photographers who want to follow in your footsteps and really make a real difference with their photography work. Now, you just mentioned there that obviously it's a challenge, and it still is a challenge for you, and you're having to continuously fight through those battles. But I'd be interested to know, so when you got these gigs with, say, well-known publications such as The Telegraph magazine, Time magazine, you're taking photographs of very well-known personalities, has that helped in, as you say, breaking down barriers, or is it still the same challenge as it was before? So I guess what I'm trying to ask is, once you get your foot in the door, so to speak, with these publications, is it then easier to continue working with these publications or similar outlets? Or not really?
Not really. Not really.
Right. Okay.
You know, for everything that I've done,
yeah,
I've worked really hard for, like every single job I've got, I've worked really hard for. Nothing has fallen in my lap.
Okay.
So the struggle is the same.
Right. Okay. So say for a budding photographer, if there's a budding photographer watching this, and they want to know the initial guidance, if you could give them one, two, or even three initial tips from your experience, what do you think that those would be?
I'd say the first one is that you don't need to go to university.
Right.
Definitely not. Definitely not. Especially not for 3 years anyway. You're better off taking one of my courses. And I genuinely mean that, to really understand how the industry works. You don't get any of that in university at all. So that's really important. Don't go to university. if you can work or assist for a working photographer, that's where you'll get the experience of how things actually work. You'll meet the editor,
right,
the producers, the art directors. You'll meet the whole network. You'll see how it functions, and you'll see how you can navigate that. That's vital. Secondly, I would say work on your style. Don't be a jack of all trades. You know, that's, you know, the difference of experience and learning and understanding and technicalities of landscape photography compared to portraiture is like night and day. They're completely two different beasts. So find out what you're really into. Spend a few months, a few years working on that, and then home in on one thing. And really, really, really work hard and be yourself. That is so important. We live in a world that is, everyone's a copy of each other. It's something that's encouraged. You know, this idea of individuality is a myth. It's a really rare thing these days. So I would encourage you that once you've understood what direction you want to go in, then try and find ways of how you can make that as individual as possible and reflect you as much as possible. So they're the things that I would really, really think about.
Okay, interesting. And you mentioned there in one of your tips to maybe buddy up with an established photographer as their assistant. Have you ever had people reaching out to you to try and test the water with, can I get an assistant position with Inzajuna Latif? Has that ever happened?
I haven't. I said I can't afford it.
You can't afford it.
No. See, the thing is, my work is, it's not the kind of work that I always need an assistant for.
Right, I see. Sure.
You know, like it's very much out there in different parts of the world.
Mm.
And, you know, like you mentioned earlier, you know, I immerse myself with those people. So I find that working alone is the best way for me.
Right. Okay.
You know, if it's a, you know, like a job for an organization, then yeah, you know, I can use an assistant then, because you need help to set up lighting, various different scenarios. So that's when it is possible. But for the majority of my work, I just don't need an assistant.
Right. I understand. But you deeply encourage people to reach out to certain photographers who may be open to this.
Yeah. And also what's important, that don't just pick any photographer.
Yeah.
A photographer whose work you like.
Because right. Okay.
You learn their tricks. And sure. Be very open to allowing you to learn those. So yeah, that's important as well.
Brilliant. I think there's some wonderful tips there, which I'm sure people can take on and put into practice. Now, Inzajuna, before we wrap up, I just wanted to ask, were there any things that you wanted to mention that we haven't perhaps covered, or things that I've maybe missed out in my questions? If I have, then feel free to mention whatever you'd like.
And I'd like to mention one thing that I'm really excited about that I've been working on for about a year now, and it's called 15-minute photo. And mm-hmm. The idea behind this, so it's a workshop that I hold that lasts between 2 to 3 hours. And the idea is for everyone to use 15 minutes in their day to go out and take a photograph. You know, many people work at a desk for many hours of the day. They don't get the opportunity to explore, to get some air. So it's all about, you know, take 15 minutes, go out, take a photograph, and let's have a conversation about it. That's the basic idea about the workshop. So that's what I'm doing now, as well as all the other stuff that I continue.
Okay, brilliant. And I imagine people can find more about 15-minute photo on your socials as well.
Yes,
they can. Yeah. Okay, brilliant. Well, look, Inzajuna, it's been an absolute pleasure connecting with you again after such a long time. I know you're leading a busy life with all the things that you're involved in, so I really, really appreciate the time you've taken out. As we mentioned earlier, there are lots of ways that people can follow your work, get in touch with you. So just a quick reminder about those guys, how you can follow Inzajin or Latif's work, first of all, the website, and it's inzajeano.com. And you can also follow his work on Instagram using the handle @_Inzajino, spelled exactly the same way as the website's first name. I have been following him on socials, especially LinkedIn and Instagram. And he's very meticulous with his work. He's updating his work on a regular basis. So please do go check him out on those platforms, in particular the website and Instagram. You've been watching the Sabir Bharti Show. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I will include all details about Inzajino in the show notes at the bottom on the description. So just in case you missed what I mentioned, I'll include it all in the links below. So yeah, thank you for watching, and until next time, take care of yourself. Enjoy the rest of your day. Take care. Bye-bye.